So we're at the beginning of the book of Vayikra, also called the priestly code, also called Torat Kohanim. There's the holiness code is in chapter 19, but for the most part, it's the rules and regulations for the ancient sacrificial rites. One of my favorite ways to understand the book of Leviticus generally is really, it's like the Judaism for dummies, for ancient Israelite culture. Like, this is their religion. This is how they went to shul. This is their, like, what you did and how you found God and practiced. This is it. We gloss over it because we, A, don't have sacrifice, and B, it's an extraordinary detail often. But it's worth noting that this is them. This is what they did. I want to focus on one verse, verse number 3. Daber el b'nei Yisrael v'marta aleihem. So talk to the people of Israel and say to them, Adam kol yakriv mikem korban ladonai. A person who wants to bring an offering to God, mina behima, a cattle offering, mina bakar, so any kind of, mina tzon, any kind of cattle, takrivu et korbanechem. It's not in the packet, I apologize. Leviticus 1:1. I don't know what page that will be. I did say verse 3. I started reading at verse 2. I was not clear at all. I apologize. I've now made it to verse 3. Yes. Im ola korbano min habakar zachar tamim yakrivenu el petach ol moed yakriv oto lirtzono lifnei Adonai. Or if his burnt offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall make his offering a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting for acceptance in his behalf before Adonai. So there's a couple of interesting things there. The male of the herd is in many ways more valuable than a female because one stag can make impregnate multiple female cattle who can then produce you more cattle. So that's worthwhile to note. Also, the burnt offering in general is a new thing that Jews bring in. The burnt offering in the ancient world didn't exist. It was one of the innovations, one of the ways they changed the sacrificial system. Sacrifices were always about a barbecue. We're always about like going and eating the food. The nicer way of saying that is that you're sharing a meal with God. The simpler way is like you can't just kill a whole animal. But we're basically, the message is when we do sacrifice, we sacrifice the whole animal. Not always, but at least some of our offerings are a total burnt offering. We burn the entire animal and give it to God as a way of greater sacrifice. Some say that it might be a compensation for getting rid of human sacrifice, that we lessen that end of sacrifice but increase this end of sacrifice. Not what we're discussing today, but just to put it on the table. What I wanted to talk about is the last two words, lifnei Adonai, before God. What does it mean to bring a sacrifice before God? What does it mean to be before God? Actually, before we get to the packets, I would just, are there any initial thoughts of what that might mean, to be before God? Okay, so a physical location. So it's excellent. Okay, anything else? Yes? Go ahead.
I would interpret it from the English, because I don't understand Hebrew, as meaning to have a mindset focused on who you are, what you're doing, and why you're doing it.
Okay, so before God, so that's the, it's about putting it what you're thinking about. Excellent. Okay, so maybe before God is within the presence of God, and since God is inside of us, somehow focusing on that part of ourselves means before God. Excellent. One, and then two.
What comes to mind is if the animal had to be pure before God, then a person might think that they had to get to a state of purity before God.
Ah, great, excellent. So there's a great drash about challah covers, that we cover the challah because we say kiddush first and we don't want the challah to be embarrassed. Which is silly, but the thought is, if you are so careful not to embarrass the challah, all the more so you'll be careful not to embarrass your fellow people. And the same here, that if you're so careful to bring an animal that is so pure, maybe you'll start to think of what you have to do to keep yourself pure. Excellent. Yes. Right, because panim is hidden in there. So, stand one, which is exactly how we do the Amidah. That's the idea, that when you bow at the beginning of the Amidah, Baruch Atah Adonai, we're supposed to be standing back up when we say God's name, because we bow to God, but when we say God's name, we face God one-to-one, Lifnei Adonai. Excellent. That's beautiful also. Yes. Great. So that will be our segue, actually. Let's turn to page. Well done. We'll start with the most concrete. Turn to page 5. Underneath where it says JPS Torah Commentary, which is this book, by the way, that I was just reading from, before the Lord, and it gives an answer for what that means. Hebrew, Lifnei Adonai, seems to delineate a defined sacred area, at times the zone beginning at the rear of the altar of burnt offerings in the sanctuary courtyard and continuing to the interior of the tent. In other passages, the zone is less specific, referring to a large space near the entrance of the courtyard. The point is that priestly law strictly limits sacrifice to a particular area and to the legitimate altar. Okay, so from on the concrete level, it is at least conceivable to read this as mean before God, meaning in the section of sacrifice area. This is where we do sacrifices. So I think that's a reasonable way to start, but that's not the only way Lifnei Adonai is used. And I want to spend some time looking at other usages of Lifnei Adonai to see how we might pull in some of the more abstract answers that we heard from the outset and see what our rabbis did with them. So first, we're going to go back to page 1. We're going to go back to Genesis chapter 10. So Nimrod, or Nimrod, is some sort of local hero, I guess. He is Abrahamic in times, but he's not part of the Abrahamic bloodline. He's parallel to Terach, who's Abraham's father. So we'll read. Is anyone else feel comfortable reading the English? Please.
Are you starting with 10?
Yeah, chapter 10, verse 8. Yeah.
8. And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Ashur and builded Nineveh and Rehoboth and Calah.
So this is a small section. Especially in the book of Genesis, we get here and there, they'll diverge for like a couple of verses to sort of explain how the rest of the world got built. And this is like several major ancient cities that seem to somehow come from this guy, Nimrod, who is said, they call him a mighty hunter, Lifnei Adonai, before God. So what do we think before God means in this context?
In God's sight.
Ah, so in God's sight. So say more.
I ran out of words.
Okay. Excellent. Yes, please. Okay, so somehow he's like superhero-esque. So he must be extra chosen. You know what it's like? It's like Mel Brooks. That's what it's like. It's like Phil. In the 2,000-year-old man, Mel Brooks says, we all worship this guy, Phil. He was bigger, he was stronger than everyone until, you know, the lightning struck Phil. And then we said, there's something bigger than Phil. But it's a similar idea that basically this must be the godlike person. He's stronger, he's bigger than everyone else. Okay? The other thing that I find interesting, and it's a little subtle move on the part of the Bible, is that Nimrod, this is not saying that God said Nimrod is Lifnei Adonai. It's saying like his title amongst the people, his nickname was, or no, not even that. It's a saying. If someone is strong, they say, you're like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the God. So there's like an implication that Adonai is somehow known by the world at large. That somehow this God of Abraham, the one that we call Adonai, that was the special name that Jews are supposed to have for God, somehow has made it into popular vernacular at least a little bit. Which is interesting, I think. Yeah.
This timeline is before the flood.
After the flood. This is Abraham. So we're 10 generations after the flood. The flood is 10 generations after Adam, and Abraham is 10 generations after the flood, according to the Bible. Right.
And then the Passover was?
So Exodus is then another 500 years or so later, give or take, according to the timeline of the Bible. Excellent. So I at least wanted to point out, at least in one context, Lifnei Adonai can mean strong or special in some way, like better than average from. And here it seems to mean, I think, like one step below God, almost. Lifnei, before God, as more like, so like if people are weak and God is strong, that Nimrod is somewhere up above there. Yes.
There's a hint, maybe more than a hint. If that, if what you just said would be an accurate appraisal, then the male hunter is given a very high place in this hierarchy, almost near the top.
So yes, unless we don't know, but this could also be, you could have, maybe the best farmer was called like Joe the farmer before God. Like, I know what I'm saying is, if maybe Lifnei Adonai is not only applied to hunter, maybe that's the phrase they used for whoever was best at whatever the thing is they did. I don't know if it's applied specifically to hunter, but the other thing is to notice that this is specifically not the Jews. And we know pretty commonly there's a dichotomy of the people that become the Jews are not hunters, and the people that are not the Jews are hunters. So there could be like a subtle dig here about non-Jews, like, oh, they privilege physical might, but it is spiritual or cunning that matters. Well, the other way around, Esau would be a descendant hypothetically of him, but no, Esau is still descended from the Abrahamic line, so, but he was the hunter, but he becomes not Jewish, ultimately. So I think, if not blood descended, I think the metaphor, the idea is still tied up in these non-Jews. They're big and strong. It's the same thing about the spies. The spies go in and check out the Canaanites. The Canaanites are giants who will crush us, but we're going to win because we have God on our side. Like they are the mighty, strong people, but we're the cunning people with God on our side. Please.
I'm a little bit lost.
Fair. Great, so we're focusing only on Lifnei Adonai, the two words before God. What does it mean to be before God? And Vayikra had us that before God, at least the simplest understanding is it means you're at the altar. Here we've got the phrase again, Lifnei Adonai, seems to mean some sort of great and powerful hunter. It's a category of being higher up, of stronger than the rest. We're going to look at a couple of other cases of Lifnei Adonai, and then some modern understanding of what it might mean to be Lifnei Adonai. So let's go next, a little bit later in Genesis. Now we're at Abraham. Abraham is standing up for Sodom and Gomorrah. And let's see what it means to be Lifnei Adonai here. Does anyone else feel up? Thank you.
And the men turned from thence and went toward Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before the Lord. And Abraham drew near and said, wilt thou indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Peradventure, there are 50 righteous within the city. Peradventure. What does that mean?
If.
What?
If. If is a reasonable.
Peradventure, there are 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou indeed sweep away and not forgive the place for the 50 righteous that are therein?
Okay, so we know that the story goes on and gets to 10, basically, and God doesn't find 10 and decides to destroy the city. But what does it mean here to be before God? But Abraham stood yet before the Lord, before Adonai. Yes, go ahead. Great. So here we get more of a sense of the facing God, the panim al panim to God, that somehow the angels, these people left presumably to go carry out God's mission. Because it says, I think the translation is good, but Abraham stood before it. So the men turned from this and went towards Sodom. So we just had this wonderful event. Abraham welcomes these three men who we know are angels into his tent, and they leave. And we, as the reader, know that they're going to kill Sodom and Gomorrah. But Abraham somehow seems to know that also and stands lifnei Adonai, before God in some sort of intercessory state. So now we've got three understandings of lifnei Adonai. Lifnei Adonai is the place in the altar where you can come to offer your sacrifice. Lifnei Adonai is somehow stronger than, better than. If you are lifnei Adonai, you are above regular humanity. And three is face-to-face to God, interceding. You can stand lifnei Adonai before God in the same way you stand before a bully or between a bully and a person. Great. Let's keep going. Exodus. Now we're talking about manna. Two. Next page. Who feels up to reading this section? Yes, from the back of the room, nice and loud.
Israel called the name thereof manna, and it was like coriander seed, white. And the taste of it was like wafers made with honey.
Excellent. It's the Midrash that adds in the bit about it tasting whatever we want it to taste like. Okay, keep going.
And Moses said, this is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. Let an overflow of it be kept throughout your generations. That they may see the bread wherewith I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth from the land.
Okay, so pause there. We don't need to read the last two verses. So here, the manna comes down, and Moses says, not only should you eat it, but let's save a tiny bit. We'll put it in some kind of jar, and I'll put it before the testimony, which is the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, meaning I'll put it with the Ark of the Covenant in our temple, and it will be before Adonai, lifnei Adonai. So what do you think it means in this context to mean lifnei Adonai? Sorry, what? Ah, interesting. That is not where I was going to go. But what you're saying is God gives us manna, and we give a little bit of it back to God as a promise of saying we understand that this is a relationship. This is a back and forth. That's wonderful. That's great. Thank you. So there's one way. Before God is, that's what it means to be before God. We're giving it back to God. That's nice. I was originally struck that it feels backwards. That in this case, we actually want this jar to be before people. That the point is not for God this time, but is for us to remember. Moses is creating some sort of like monument or wall or plaque to say, you know, this is for the remembering about the manna for forever. This is an amazing miracle God did for us, and you guys are whiners, and I don't want you to ever forget about it. Yes.
Maybe it's just that God wouldn't forget to take care of us.
Oh, the other way.
Be a reminder that he chose us and he's trying to help us. So he, like a covenant, but so he wouldn't forget that he promised.
Remember, we need you. Please. Great, yes.
I think it's their way of saying thank you to God, just to always appreciate what God has given. It's a recognition and to give thanks.
Excellent. So I think in this case, lifnei Adonai does all of these things. Did you have a hand? Yes.
It means that you don't have to worry that there's going to be food enough throughout the generation.
Oh, it's also wow. This is a good one. Okay, so we've got, It is our gift back to God. It's a reminder for us to be happy and grateful. It's a reminder to God to take care of us. It's also a reminder to us to remember that we were taken care of once and we'll be taken care of again. Great, yes.
I was just thinking, the tabernacle where I think all this is going on is sort of like a museum of keepsakes, a place where we keep those things that are important to us from our life. The Ten Commandments and now the jar of manna and other items that are part of our history and our remembrance.
Great. So the whole tabernacle is our Lifnei Adonai spot then. It's our spot where we keep the stuff that we get that is before God. It's our holy shrine spot where we keep that stuff. So when we go there, we are before God because we see all of the things that remind us of the many great things God has done for us in different ways. Great. I saw a hand back. Were you raising your hand? No? Yes, okay, one and two.
Has anything replaced the manna?
Does anyone what?
Has anything replaced the manna because this is to be kept throughout the generation?
No, this is the last I remember hearing of it in the Bible, which doesn't mean it's not there somewhere and I don't remember it, but I think it gets lost is the idea that we don't know. On a side note, there is something somewhere that people think they found what manna probably was, that there is some plant that like produces dew in the morning, and when you grind up the whatever, it comes to some sort of flowery-like substance that grows specifically in wildernessy desert.
I wonder whether the eternal light might have replaced it.
The that's beautiful. But we Ne'er Tamid is already there. We're supposed to have a candle burning always, so it's not replacing it. So those are both there. As far as I know, nothing, at least nothing explicitly replaces this. I mean, you can make lots of beautiful arguments, but. All right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Great.
Is this the first time we get the foreshadowing of a sacrifice?
That's a good question. Well, Moses says to Pharaoh, let us go make an offering to God. There are implications, and Abraham does the Brit Ben Abitarim, which is sacrifice-esque, which is the covenant between the pieces of animals. But I do, this is the very beginning of the process of building the tabernacle. So I do think that this is perhaps the very beginning of organized sacrifice as opposed to more spontaneous moved to do it sacrifice. That's a good point. Interesting. So we start with the manna. Great. With what we have also, which is what makes sense. Yes.
Rainbow acts to remind God of his covenant.
Interesting.
Not to remind us.
Interesting. So we have prior examples. In fact, when God does something nice, God seems to need a reminder of like the nice times.
Yeah.
No, it's an interesting point. And even if it's not a reminder for God, it's almost nice of us to think of it as a reminder of God. It's a way of hoping. Like of reminding us to remind God to be nice to us. Like, that sort of interchange. That's nice. Yeah. Please.
What does 34 mean? As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony. What did God command? What does this mean here?
So we don't have Moses actually doing the commanding. I'd have to go back and look at chapter 16 and see if he says it first. But on 32... Moses said, God commanded me to tell you to let this little chunk of manna be saved. And so now Aaron is doing it. And it basically is saying, and so as God commanded, Aaron is doing that.
So God had commanded that this portion of it be saved.
Yeah, so I don't know if you're making we don't actually have God commanding. We have Moses saying God commanded. I don't know if that's what you're playing up or not. I don't know if you're asking, do we trust that Moses means that? Because this particular sounds very like a human thing. But yes. Okay, yes. Go ahead.
No, sorry, I'm behind you. Manna was
Excellent. So Moses, is like from here on out, basically, is a man obsessed with legacy. So I think 100%, and the entire book of Deuteronomy is his speech to the people. Stand, like, don't go into Israel yet. I have a couple more words. So I think that is totally legitimate, at least to see it as that way, as Moses trying to think of every mechanism possible to keep the legacy going. Great, yes. One, and then two, and then three. Great.
It seems we're ascribing a lot of importance to this jar.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the continuation of the importance of the jar in the Torah, like the Decalogue is?
Yeah, it's a great question.
So important, and yet I don't know of any.
I don't know of any other reference to it, to be perfectly honest. And now I'm curious. I'm going to look it up for next time. But it occurs to me I have no other reference. It's a great point. Yeah. All right, fight over it.
But if manna is such an important part of the Exodus, I'm very surprised that it doesn't appear on the Seder plate.
In some way.
It just.
I have a great story for you. A friend of when I was in Israel for the year, a friend of mine was in Israel also, and she was doing a master's of public health. The Hebrew U has like a bring people from all over the world, and a number of them are third world country getting a master's in public health so they can go back and try and treat them. So, well, two things. The first is that people from the third world country did not understand diabetes or obesity. It was like the Americans like had to deal with that, and they were like, what is this nonsense? And the second thing was fascinating. So this guy came to, I want to say from Somalia, from somewhere in Africa, I'm blanking where, and he says to my friend who's helping him around Jerusalem and show him different things, he said, so they went to the shuk together, and this guy looks at her and says, so which stall sells manna? I've been dying to try manna. It's just like a reminder of like the different like way in which we see the world. But that's the way it goes. All right, I've got one more for us. How are we doing? We're doing great. One more biblical for us, and then we'll talk about it a little more, and then I want to turn to Heschel, to Abraham Joshua Heschel. Okay, who feels up for reading Deuteronomy? Please.
This is page 3.
Yes. Okay, so pause there. So I brought this for two reasons. One, we're going into Pesach. The truth is, so I searched Lifnei Adonai, and it comes up a lot of times in the Bible. So I did not, this is not an exhaustive list at all, but I tried to pick different ones. So we have one that's sacrificial and one that's about humanity, like different things like that. Now, I'm out of packets. You got to share. I'm sorry. I bring it up first, a word about the Haggadah. So the Haggadah is based on these couple of lines, which were said on Shavuot. That on Shavuot, you took your basket of first fruits and you brought them to the temple, and this is the incantation. This is the prayer you said. These are the words you said that offered the first fruits to God. The reason the Haggadah is so brilliant is that everyone knew these six lines. These couple of verses, everyone knew them. It was universal to the Jewish world. So the Haggadah takes the words that you know and makes that the outline for the Pesach story. So it's what makes the Seder so accessible to everyone, is it's got a foundation, a story, a skeleton that everyone else knows. So that's aside. But now for our point, and thou shalt speak and say before the Lord thy God, Lifnei Adonai Elohecha. So what does it mean to say these words before God?
Addressing God.
Okay, so one, maybe it's to God. They could have said to God. Mm-hmm. Seems to me it's got to mean something a little more than to God. Yes.
Again, he's saying you have to remember where you came from. Mm-hmm. And he's you're telling, before God, you're stating, I remember what you did for us, and I will never forget.
Great. Okay.
It sort of sounds like a vow to share the story with everyone else in your children and generations.
Great. So it's like it's got an oath feel to it. It's a formal, like you say something to someone, you vow before someone. Beautiful. Yes. Okay, so in this case, we have to go to the temple. It means go say this before Adonai at the right spot.
Yeah.
Oh, great. And before that, it said at the altar of God. Actually, that's the argument for why it doesn't mean a physical location. Because in the verse before, we have to set it down before the altar of the Lord thy God. So we're already there. So maybe the next verse before God means something else. Maybe not. I mean, it's you can read it either way, but that's something there. Okay, I want to turn to the Talmud quickly. So turn to page 5. Oh, I forgot about that one. No, I don't want to do that anymore. We also stand before, I'm going to tell you, we also stand before God when we accept the Decalogue. When we accept the Ten Commandments, then Lifnei Adonai is used there again. I think we've exhausted our energy for the Bible, so we're going to move into the Talmud. In the middle there where it says, Talmud Bavli Brachot 28b. Our rabbis taught when Rabbi Eliezer fell ill, his disciples went to visit him. They said to him, Master, teach us the paths of life so that we may, through them, win the life of the future world. He said to them, Be solicitous for the honor of your colleagues and keep your children from meditation. I don't know what that means. And set them between the knees of scholars. And here's the one that matters for us. And when you pray, know before whom you are standing. And in this way, you will win the future world. So win the future world is like code for heaven, basically, for the Jewish version of heaven. It's the extent that it is like the Christian version of heaven is that it is after death. Otherwise, the difference is there's very little similarity, but still. This becomes a very common phrase in synagogues. Synagogues today often, in front of their ark, have the phrase, Da lifnei mi ata omed, know before whom you stand, which is, you know, secretly why I was interested in the phrase lifnei Adonai, trying to understand where that comes from. It also comes from, there's a psalm that says, Shiviti neged Adonai tamid, which is, set yourself opposite God always. And maybe another time we'll do this, but there's a whole art form called the Shiviti, which is some sort, often it's with word art, and sometimes it's with, you know, paintings. It's become popular again in different circles, but it's a thing you hang in your synagogue or the place where you pray that's meant to help focus you, as if you're Shiviti, setting yourself before Adonai. Oftentimes, it's playing with the word Adonai, that somehow it is using Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as either an acronym or as those letters as the form of the artwork. If you go, they're really popular in Sephardic shuls. If you go to a Sephardic shul, you probably may not even notice it the first time, but on the wall, there's often something. It looks kind of like a menorah with words often or something like that, and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is buried in there somewhere, and that's a Shiviti. Okay. So now we've got this idea, know before whom you stand. We've got a wide array of understandings of what it means to be before God from the Bible. And now I want to take and change gears somewhat dramatically and read some Heschel. So for those of you who are not familiar at all with Abraham Joshua Heschel, first of all, you're in for a treat. he is a rabbi that lived in the last century. He escaped from Europe. He basically was, the Hebrew Union College bought him out of Europe, basically. They recognized him as a great scholar. The Reform Movement was not the place for him. I'm not sure any movement was the place for him, but he settled in the Conservative Movement. And he is famous, most famous, literally, because he marched with Dr. King. He's got a famous quote that basically says, I feel like I'm praying with my feet when I do these kinds of things. He was very socially conscious. His daughter, Susanna, is still sort of publishes. He is... What?
She was one of the first female rabbis.
something along the, that sounds right to me. And he is the people describe his writing to be more like music than like books, whereas music doesn't give you an idea, it presents you with a feeling and circles an idea and comes back to it and moves around. It's non-linear for the most part. I'm not an expert on music, but if that sounds right to you, go with it. He's similar also. It was said that he wrote his books that he would like every so often stop and write down like a sentence and like stuff it in his pocket, and he would sit at his desk and arrange all of the sentences, and then that would be his book. The one exception to all of this is a book I encourage for everyone. It's a beautiful book called The Sabbath. The disadvantage is you get a wonderful book, but it's nothing like the rest of his stuff, so you don't get this sort of meandering, beautiful turn of phrase that you're never quite sure. I was just talking to friends about him, and I like to describe him as saying he's particularly good that when you read him, you simultaneously know what he means and have no idea what he's saying. So you keep coming back to him. But The Sabbath is different. It's a treatise about Shabbat and about time. It's interesting in of itself. This is from Man's Quest for God, a beautiful book. It's translated in English. One of his amazing things is that his command of language, considering he's not a native English speaker, his command of English is like 1,000 times better than mine is. And I grew up with it. It's just amazing. So he's quotable. So you'll find him around often. Yes.
So he wrote it in English?
No, he wrote it in English.
All of his books?
No, I think he wrote some in Hebrew, but anything that was translated, he did the translation.
Himself.
Yeah. Right now, we're looking at Man's Quest for God. The book I mentioned before is called The Sabbath. We have a bunch of them in the library. If you go up to share, they'll show you many of them. Another is Heavenly Torah. We're also going to look at Man is Not Alone. They're amazing. And you can do like a page or two a day, that kind of thing. Any more than that, and you won't have any idea what he's saying. All right. So one of his books, he's famous for, like, he's got these little titles and little paragraphs. So he had one on know. So the phrase is know before whom you stand. So we're going to do before whom and you stand. He already did know. We were not focusing on that one. To have said before what? We're on page 4, to be clear. Sorry. Before whom? To have said before what would have contradicted the spirit of Jewish prayer. What is the most indefinite pronoun? In asking what, one is totally uncommitted, uninitiated, bare of any anticipation of an answer. Any answer may be acceptable. But he who is totally uncommitted, who does not even have an inkling of the answer, has not learned the meaning of the ultimate question and is not ready to engage in prayer. If God is a what, a power, the sum total of values, how can we pray to it? An I does not pray to an it. Unless, therefore, God is at least as real as my own self, unless I am sure that God has at least as much life as I do, how can I pray? So first I'll hear any reactions or thoughts or... Yeah.
In today's contemporary lingo, when you say something to somebody, you go, what?
Right.
They keep coming back at the what? Like, how could I possibly be involved in this?
Great. So when we study Rashi, the guy we talked about last week a little bit, you're supposed to ask Makashel Rashi. What's bothering Rashi? What's the question? Rashi's always answering a question. He never tells you what the question is he's answering. It's your first job to figure that out on your own. But here, too, there's an implied question that he's answering. I want to be sharp. What is the question? What is his problem with before whom that he wants to explain? Right, that's his answer. Good. What's his question? It's a specific living entity. It's not a vague power. And I think that's at least on the level of his answer. I think his question is, who is a person? Mm-hmm. Who is inherently a person? God has to not be a person because it's God. In fact, calling God a person is that terrible thing we just called idolatry. So he wants to explain here, what do we mean by whom? And he says, basically, language is insufficient. But what is worse? What might be closer to avoiding the issue of idolatry, but it also has no life? It also has nothing that we can hold on to or sink our teeth into. So when we say whom, he's implicitly answering. We don't mean who, which person. Know which person you before you stand. We mean whom, which being, which entity, which thing like us that is more than us are we praying to? Great.
Devilish mind, yeah.
Say it, what?
Unless I am sure that God has at least as much life as I do. Mm-hmm. Our life is terminal. Our life is finite.
Right.
Does the Hebrew say life in that way? Because that word life twists the sentence sort of tough.
So it's an interesting way of, you never know with Heschel exactly what he means. But I think what he means, I think vitality is more what he means than life. Mm-hmm. Unless God has at least as much presence in the world, at least as much reality, at least as much livingness. And we call God the living God, as I do, how can I pray? In other words, the problem could be that with whom, it sounds like you're saying idolatry. But he's saying, unless I give God at least as much life as I do, then it becomes idolatry because then we have a dead God.
For a man who had such a way with words, I suspect that word life, for me,
yeah,
that word life must refer only to the God that's within us. It cannot be a separate entity.
Ah. Okay, so it's interesting. People write books on Heschel and will come to very opposite conclusions on what he thinks about things because of his sort of writing style. And because really he's about bridging unbridgeable gaps. He's about holding on to dichotomies that seem to contradict each other. And at the very least, in other cases, he's pretty clear that God has to be more than just inside of us, that God has to be God's own thing also. But it's a fair question. The other two things I want to point out is that Heschel is very good with language, and there are a subtle homage and a subtle dig here to other people. An I does not pray to an it is an homage to Martin Buber, who is a famous theologian. His famous book is I and Thou. And he loved Buber, definitely read Buber, as you know, saying that this has to be about relationship. And the sum total of values has to do with his chief, maybe we'll do one just on Heschel and Kaplan, his chief, in Hebrew you say bar plugta, which is your opposite, the person you argued with about everything, was Mordechai Kaplan. Mordechai Kaplan eventually becomes the founder of the Reconstructionist movement, but they're both at the seminary at the same time. Heschel is all about God. Spirituality is even too vague. He gave a great speech before the RA where he condemns the entire conservative rabbinate, basically, and basically says, all of you have birthday Shabbat and anniversary Shabbat and young kid Shabbat. When are we going to have Shabbat Shabbat? You can't read it without screaming at someone. It's but that's his thing about God. And Kaplan is all about people. It's all about how we function as a people, and his conception of God is less of an entity and more of the direction that we move towards good in the world, or the name we give for good values that push us in the right direction. So in one paragraph, I just want to point out, because I love this guy, I've never met him, Heschel has helped us understand how we can call God a person but not be idolatrous. has put away this idea of a God without life that Kaplan is talking about, and has boosted up the idea of relationship God that Buber is talking about. How are we doing? I got 5 minutes. So I actually want to end on the next page. I like You Stand also, but in Man Is Not Alone, another one. I'll end with these ones because I just love it. What does it mean to be before God? So page 5 at the top. A tremor seizes our limbs. Our nerves are struck, quiver like strings. Our whole being bursts into shudders, but then a cry, wrested from our very core, fills the world around us as if a mountain were suddenly about to place itself in front of us. It is one word, God. Not an emotion, a stir within us, but a power, a marvel beyond us, tearing the world apart. The word that means more than universe, more than eternity. Holy, 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 we cannot comprehend it. We only know it means infinitely more than we are able to echo. Staggered, embarrassed, we stammer and say, He who is more than all there is, who speaks through the ineffable, whose question is more than our mind can answer, He to whom our life can be the spelling of an answer. And I think that's when you put all of the answers we've come together, what we mean about being before God. If we can get to this point ever in our life, then we will have stood before God. With that, I wish us a week full of sacrifice. We'll rise. Yes. We rise together for Kaddish de Rabbanan.